You're listening to a program produced in 2016 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud. Now we can turn our attention to another time and place, the dark and peaty Irish countryside in the mid-19th century, and the real reason we're here tonight, to hear the wondrous Emma Donoghue, author of the contemporary thriller Room, in conversation with novelist Ramona Azurbel, in a conversation about Emma's new book, The Wonder. The Wonder centers on a pious girl in an Irish village and a skeptical English nurse who watches over her. It's been called both a whodunit and a scorching meditation on the malignant folly of fundamentalism. If you can't stay, just a note for the book signing tonight, as we will probably go past 9 p.m., we have some pre-signed books by both of our authors for sale in the lobby. And for the Q&A, please note we'll be circulating microphones to you as we do record for podcast. And I'm keeping my intro very short tonight. Emma Donoghue is the author of more than a dozen books. The Wonder is her 9th novel, the first set in her homeland of Ireland. And tonight with Ramona Azurbel, her debut novel is No One Is Here Except All of Us, won the Penn USA Fiction Award, and her new novel, which Vanity Fair called devilishly imaginative, is Sons and Daughters of Ease and Plenty. And we're going to start tonight with a reading by Emma. Please welcome both Emma Donoghue and Ramona Azurbel. Thank you.
Hello, thank you very much for staying. I know it's hard to think about anything else. So let's, just for a little mental break, let's go back to 1859, the Irish boglands, that wet bit in the middle. No particular village, because I didn't really think that any particular village in Ireland would be glad to have me set this fictional story there. My point of view character is an English nurse called Lib Wright, and she has been sent to Ireland from a London hospital to do a two-week private nursing job. She's one of the new breed of nurses, the Nightingale-trained nurses who worked in the Crimean War. So she's horrified on arrival to find that this is really not a nursing job, but a two-week surveillance. She and another nurse, a nun, are being asked to watch this little girl, Anna O'Donnell, an 11-year-old whose family claimed that she's lived without food for 4 months. So I think that's all you need to know. This is about the second day. Lib inched the dresser away from the wall to make sure there was nothing hollowed out behind it where food could be hidden. Tugging out each drawer, the wood was warped from damp, of course, she went through the girl's small stock of clothes, fingering every seam and hem. On top of the dresser sat a drooping dandelion in a jar. Miss Nightingale rather approved of flowers in sick rooms, scorning the old wives' tale about them poisoning the air. She said that brilliancy of colour and variety of form uplifted not only the mind but the body. In Lib's first week at the hospital in London, she tried to explain that to Matron, who'd called her la-di-da. It occurred to Lib now that the dandelion might be a source of nourishment hiding in plain sight. Or what about the liquid? Was it really water, or perhaps some kind of clear broth or syrup? Lib sniffed at the jar, but all her nose registered was the familiar tang of dandelion. She dipped her finger in the liquid and then put it to her lips, as tasteless as it was colourless. But might there be some kind of nutritive element that had those qualities? Lib could tell without looking that the girl was watching her. Oh, come now, Lib was falling into the trap of the old Dr. McBrady's delusions. This was just water. She wiped her hand on her apron. Beside the jar, nothing but a small wooden chest. Not even a mirror, it struck Lib now. Did Anne O'Donnell never want to look at herself? She opened the box, and the girl jumped up. Those are my treasures, she said. Lovely. May I see? Lib's hands were already busy inside the chest, in case Anna was going to claim that these were private too, like her prayers. Certainly, said Anna. Pious gimcrackery, Lib thought. A set of rosary beads made of seeds, was it? With a plain cross on the end, and a painted candlestick in the shape of the Virgin and Child. Isn't it beautiful? Anna reached out for the candlestick. Mammy and Daddy gave it to me on my confirmation.
An important day, murmured Lib neutrally. The statuette was too sickly sweet for her taste. She felt it all over to make sure it was really porcelain, not something edible. Only then did she let the girl take it.
Anna held it to her chest. Confirmation's the most important day, she said.
Why is that? Asked Lib.
'Tis the end of being a child.
Darkly comic, Lib found it, the slip of a thing thinking of herself as a grown woman. Next, she peered at the writing on a tiny silvery oval, no bigger than the top of her finger.
That's my miraculous medal, said Anna, lifting it out of Lib's hand.
Oh, what miracles has it done?
That came out too flippant, but the girl did not take offence. Ever so many, she assured Lib, rubbing the medal. Not this one, I mean, but all the miraculous medals in Christendom together.
Lib didn't comment. At the bottom of the box in a glass case, she found a tiny disc. Not metal, but white, this one, stamped with a lamb carrying a flag and a coat of arms. It couldn't be the bread from Holy Communion, could it? Surely that would be sacrilege to keep the host in a toy box. What's this, Anna? She asked.
My Agnus Dei.
Lamb of God. Lib knew that much Latin. She flipped up the lid of the case and she grated the disc with her nail.
Don't break it.
I won't, she said. It wasn't bread, she realised, but wax. She laid the box in Anna's cupped hand.
Each one's been blessed by His Holiness in Rome, the child assured her, clicking the lid shut. Agnus Dei's make floods go down and put out fires.
Lib puzzled over the origin of this legend. Considering how fast wax melted, who could imagine it much use against fire? Nothing left in the chest but a few books. She inspected the titles, all devotional. A Missal for the Use of the Laity, The Imitation of Christ. She plucked an ornamented rectangle about the size of a playing card out of the black book of Psalms.
Put it back where it lives, said Anna, agitated.
Ah, could there be food hidden in the book?
Just a moment,
Lib riffled through the pages. But there was nothing there but more little rectangular cards.
Those are my holy cards, said Anna. Each one has its own place.
The one Lib held was a printed prayer with a fancy cut border like lace, and it had another of those tiny medals tied onto it with a ribbon. On the back, in saccharine pastels, a woman cuddled a sheep. Divine bergère, it said at the top. Divine something?
See, this one matches Psalm 118, said Anna. I have gone astray like a sheep that is lost.
And she tapped the page without needing to check what it said. Very Mary had a little lamb, thought Lib. She saw now that all the books in the chest were studded with these little rectangular cards.
Who gave you these cards? Some of them were prizes at school when I went to school or at the mission, said Anna, or presents from visitors.
Where's this mission?
It's gone now. My brother left me some of the loveliest cards, said Anna, kissing the sheep card before tucking it into its place and closing the book.
What a curious child, thought Lib.
Do you have a favourite saint? Anna shook her head. They all have different things to teach us. Some of them were born good, but others were very wicked until God cleaned their hearts.
Oh, yes, said Lib.
He can pick anyone to be holy, Anna assured her.
When the door burst open, Lib jumped. It was Kitty the slavey with the basin of hot water.
Sorry to keep you. I'm after bringing himself his meal, said the young woman, panting.
She must mean the father, Malachy O'Donnell, who was off cutting turf for a neighbour today, wasn't he?
What'll I be scrubbing for you? Asked the maid.
I will do that, said Lib, taking the basin. She couldn't allow any of the family access to this room. Kitty might have food for the child tucked in her apron right now, for all Lib knew. The maid frowned. In confusion or resentment?
You must be busy, said Lib.
Oh, and could I trouble you for another chair as well as fresh bedding?
A sheet, asked Kitty.
A pair of them, Lib corrected her, and a clean blanket.
We've none, said the maid, shaking her head.
Such a vacant expression on the broad face, Lib wondered if Kitty was quite all there.
No clean sheets yet, she means, Anna put in. Wash day is Monday next, you see, unless 'tis too wet.
I see, said Lib, suppressing her irritation. Well, just the second chair then, Kitty, please. She added chlorinated soda from a bottle in her bag to the basin of water, and she wiped down every surface in the room. The smell was harsh but clean. She made the child's bed again with the same tired sheets and grey blanket. Straightening up, she wondered where else in the room a mouthful of food could possibly be stashed.
This was nothing like the cluttered sick rooms of the upper classes that she'd nursed in. Apart from the bed, dresser and chair, there was only a woven mat on Anna's floor with a pattern of darker lines. Lib lifted it up, nothing underneath. The room would be very cheerless if she took the mat away, as well as chill underfoot. Besides, the most likely place to hide a crust or an apple was in the bed, and surely the committee didn't mean her to make the girls sleep on bare boards like a prisoner. No, Lib would just have to inspect Anna's bedroom at frequent and unpredictable intervals to make sure no food had been sneaked in. Kitty brought in the chair at last and thumped it down. "You might take this mat and beat the dust out when you have a moment," said Lib politely. "And tell me, where would I find a scales to weigh Anna?" Kitty shook her head. "In the village, perhaps?" Lib prompted.
"We use fists," said Kitty.
Lib frowned.
"Fistfuls of flour, like, you know, and pinches of salt."
The slavey mimed them in the air. "No, I don't mean household scales," Lib told her. "Something big enough to weigh a person, like Anna, or an animal, perhaps on one of the neighbouring farms?"
Kitty shrugged tiredly.
Anna, watching the curling dandelion in the jar, gave no sign of hearing any of this, as if it were some other little girl's weight that was in question. Lib sighed. "A jug of cold water, please, then, and a teaspoon."
"Did you want a bit of something?" Kitty asked on her way out.
The phrase confused Lib.
"Or can you wait for your dinner?"
"Oh, I can wait," said Lib. She regretted her words the moment the maid was gone, because she was hungry. But somehow in front of Anna O'Donnell, she could not declare that she was desperate for her dinner. Which was absurd, she reminded herself, given that the girl was nothing but a shammer. I'll leave that there. Thank you.
Thank you, Emma. That was beautiful. And I just want to open by congratulating you on a beautiful and really thought-provoking book.
Thank you.
And a very warm reception. So I'm sure we're all so glad to be here and to switch over to Ireland for a little while and let all of that go, although there are a lot of things that tie in, I think, with the novel. Maybe you could just start by talking about how the seeds were sown in you and where these stories first kind of got a hold of you.
This story is a fictional one, but there are about 50 real cases of what were called fasting girls, or sometimes miraculous maidens. They included the occasional young man and some older women, but most of them were young women or teenage girls, or very young, even prepubescent ones like Anne O'Donnell. And each of them, quite separate from the others, would hit the headlines at some point between the 16th century and the 20th for an apparent ability to live without food. They weren't all in the Catholic tradition. Some of them were Protestant. Some of them made no particular religious claims at all. In fact, often we don't know anything of what the girls said about themselves. Often we just know that somebody wrote to the papers about them. So there were like little blank pages on which all the theories of their day would be projected, and very odd theories were included there. Some people claimed that these girls could live off the power of sunlight, or that they could reabsorb their own periods, or that they could live off tobacco. I mean, there were all sorts of crazy theories. But one thing I came to think about while writing this book was that we are rarely rational about health. You know, and we eat what's bad for us. We place all our trust in miracle berries. You know, there's always massive resistance to state vaccination campaigns. You know, it's just health, and perhaps food in particular, is just not a subject on which we are very calm or rational. So anyway, yeah, the fasting girls are what really inspired this novel, and I first came across them about 20 years ago. But I've come to realize that actually the seeds of this novel go back farther for me. When I was 11, Irish Republican prisoners in a Northern Irish jail went on hunger strike. There's a long tradition of hunger strike in Ireland for political purposes, and 10 of them fasted to death. And as an 11-year-old, I was simultaneously kind of horrified by the emotional blackmail of this, and I didn't like the Republican cause at all, but also, of course, I was deeply moved at the commitment of these prisoners to their self-appointed cause. Again, a few years after that, when I was a teenager, Ireland had an outbreak of moving statues, where lots of people would go and stare at holy statues in a grotto and would become collectively convinced that they saw them move or weep or otherwise communicate with the crowd. So I think those incidents left a strong kind of thumbprint on me, such that here I am all these decades later, driven to write about Ireland's particular relationship with hunger and with faith.
So you had all of these stories kind of stewing around, and how does your process work? When you, do you do you sort of take that research and then step aside from it to create the story, or do you feel like you're sort of winding it through all along?
I do a huge amount of research initially, and then I continue to go back and do more research whenever I need to find another detail, because the research is never just the background. I get some of my best storylines by immersing myself in the research. I do what Donald Trump would call great swatches of research. I try never to sort of count the cost of my time. You know, I never say to myself, will this pay off? I just say to myself, I wonder, you know, how many prayers they thought you had to say to get a soul out of purgatory. And then I just spend a week on the internet trying to pursue that answer. Similarly, I'll say to myself, you know, oh, bogland landscape, that's interesting. I wonder, you know, do people ever drown in bogs? And so I'll spend 3 days reading about bogs. Sometimes I'm looking up what I think will be just background, and it gives me actual characters. For instance, there's a key character in this book who's a journalist. I mean, basically, as you'll have seen from that excerpt, the very rational, scientific English nurse is strongly contrasted with all these Irish peasant characters who are not only dropping down on their knees all the time to pray, but they're also leaving out milk for the fairies. So they have a lot of beliefs. And to sort of complicate it and triangulate it, I bring in a character of a Dublin journalist who is an Irish Catholic, but is rather sort of modern and rational like Lib is. And when I was trying to work out what he would be like, I read a lot about Irish journalism in the 19th century, and I found that because it was a small market, they had to be very flexible. Nowadays, journalists have to provide content on many platforms, but in those days you had to, you know, alter your politics too, and that a lot of these journalists would write very Republican pieces for one newspaper and middle of the road ones for another, and then staunchly unionist pieces for another. You simply had to adapt your song to the market. And so I started thinking about this journalist who would actually be quite an idealistic fellow with his own opinions, but he has been trained to just provide each employer with the kind of content that the employer is expecting. So there's this kind of tension between, you know, worldly cynicism in the media and its kind of beating heart, because I suppose I saw a nurse and a journalist as fairly similar in that when they're forced to either report on or watch over a bad situation, of course they can't stay neutral. They will start to care about it. And one of the things that inspired this book was that in several cases of real fasting girls, there was a watch put on them, a sort of formal surveillance. And in one of the most famous cases in Wales, the case of Sarah Jacob, as soon as the media got involved and hired nurses to watch the child, she very quickly starved to death. So I suppose as a novelist, I was particularly transfixed by the horror that by paying attention to a situation, you could actually find yourself making it worse, that you become complicit with what you're looking at.
Right. And that each of the characters in the book is kind of blinded by their own vocation. They each have their training and their role to fill, and they're only looking as far as that. And many of them, Lib is able to see beyond that line, but it takes her a while to get there.
Oh yeah, and she arrives, you know, I knew that she would be the character that my 21st century readers would probably connect with most easily. She's nearer to us in her mindset because she's quite scientific and rational. But I didn't want her to be Miss Perfect. I mean, it's not an interesting novel to me unless everybody changes, you know. All cells have to be thrown into the little petri dish, you know. I need everyone to change. So she arrives with a head full of anti-Irish and anti-Catholic baggage. I mean, the Irish were really considered the losers of Europe who had brought the famine on themselves. So yes, she has to do an awful lot of questioning herself, because not only are many of her prejudices unfair, but they actually blind her. She can't read the situation correctly. That when she finds a saucer of milk under a dresser, she assumes that this is how the child is sneaking food, and actually it's milk left out for the fairies, which any of the Irish characters would have known. She goes out for a walk and she sees a man in a hole in the bog holding on by one arm. She assumes he's drowning. He's actually cutting turf. So, you know, like maybe a Westerner sent off to a sub-Saharan African country to help out, you know, she blunders as she has all the book smarts, but she doesn't know the territory. She doesn't know the culture, so she makes a lot of mistakes.
Right, so she's able to see, in a way, as an outsider, she has an advantage when she's looking at Anna, because she is able to see it, you know, with new eyes. But meanwhile, she nearly drowns in a bog one day while she pulls herself out. But she really has the landscape is completely foreign to her. Some of that, I loved that writing about Ireland so much. It's such an evocative landscape. But I also loved that it was written through Lib's point of view a lot of the time. And Lib misses all the beauty. She just sees this sort of gray, terrible, flat desolate place. But well, I think they did, we readers tastes. See both.
Yeah, you know, we some of the landscapes in Ireland now that we think of as most exquisite, what we're basically looking at is desolation, in that these are areas that used to be heavily populated and then everybody died out. So, you know, it happens to suit our eye. We like the ruined and the empty and the natural, but to Victorians that just looked like, you know, it looked like a really bad recession to them. It was like, you know, where are the thrifty little cottages with their smoking fires, you know?
What was it like to write about Ireland?
It was such a pleasure to go back to my homeland, which I left at 20. Now, I've never been away even 6 months. I go back regularly. But it was lovely to go back there as a writer and to really kind of worry away at the root of Ireland's intimate relationship with the Catholic Church, which, I mean, I tried to be fair in that I'm saying a lot in this book that's quite harsh about a particular aspect of Catholicism, the kind of very anti-body, anti-flesh, anti-appetite, anti-food, anti-sex side of things. But I also want to show that these Irish characters cling to their faith because it gives such meaning to their miserable lives. You know, it promises them that everything will be better next time, that they are worth as much as the Queen of England, you know, that the meek will inherit the earth, the last will be first. You could see how to you know, an 11-year-old Irish girl in the 1850s who's never going to have a job, you know, may not even get married, certainly won't ever have a vote. It gives a huge amount of meaning and dignity to her life, and you can see why she might cling to it even if it's going to kill her.
Yeah, absolutely. So thinking about all those bodies and what they are supposed to do and not supposed to do, the action of the novel is essentially a bunch of adults watching a single young female body waste away. And I thought, I just kept thinking about that little body and the symbol that it is, the different symbol that it is to everybody. Did you think about that a lot?
I did. And I have a 9-year-old daughter who's, you know, full of health and vigor and appetite. So, you know, she was a great kind of indirect inspiration to me for this book, because I would look at her and she'd be just so brimming with life and confidence, and I would think, okay, what about a little girl like her, equally intelligent and thoughtful, but she's in a situation of fundamentalist values and groupthink, such that the message she's absorbing is, aren't you a good girl to not eat too much? You're a good girl to put up with things. You're a good girl to not complain. And so she decides to apply those rules in an absolute way. So yes, I was very aware of the kind of the pathos of this child at the center of things. And everyone in the village has a different stake in her story, you know. A few of them want her to be disproved as a hoax, but most of them are secretly hoping that she'll become either a medical miracle. I mean, the doctor is hoping that she's an example of a new kind of metabolism. People who don't need food, wouldn't that be wonderful? He thinks that'll end all wars. You know, several in the village are hoping that she'll be proved as a saint. The priest is actually very ambivalent in his attitude because the Catholic Church is very nervous of declaring anyone to be a miracle who may then be found out as not. So, I wanted her to be like this little blank page. And one scene in particular, when the committee are all sitting around debating her as her health fails, I couldn't help but be reminded of, you know, current debates in Ireland. We're currently debating whether or not to bring in reproductive freedom in Ireland. And there are many situations where, you know, you'll have a whole lineup of different authority figures all discussing what some teenage girl should have the right to do. Yeah.
Right. People deciding about other people's bodies, sometimes because they're younger, but not always. Did it change the way you thought about that in the writing of the book, studying it that carefully?
I think it just gave me even more of a stake in the story, you know? And I also was inspired by, I've never had, you know, anyone close to me with an eating disorder, but I have a good friend who's a teenage, well, now grown up, a daughter with an eating disorder. And I was very moved by how difficult it is for parents to make those decisions about how to look after their young loved one with an eating disorder, because it points to a fundamental controversy in the parent-child relationship, which is that when they're tiny babies, we carry them around as if they're part of us. And when they're 18, they're free to go. And at every point between 0 and 18, you have to renegotiate that bond based on how old they are, what their capacities are, what the particular temperament of the child is. So this is intensified when there's something like an eating disorder, because there are such different schools of thought. You know, some people saying, oh, the teenager needs to separate from her parents and have autonomy and respect her separateness. And then others saying, no, she desperately needs the calories. She can't think straight until you feed her. So I think eating disorders are particularly painful because they highlight that confusion about how much do we let children make their own decisions.
Right, and what kinds of stories we're giving them and asking them to hold for us. And Anna is carrying these stories that she has inherited from her family and from the church about how everybody is supposed to be, and she doesn't know how to understand the stories all the time.
Yeah, I think children absorb the messages we give them, even if those messages are not consciously spelled out. For instance, my daughter a few years ago horrified me. She was saying something about doctors, and I said, oh, you could be a doctor. And she said, and I quote, I'm a girl, I'd have to be a nurse. And I thought, okay, the only doctors she's ever had were women. You know, no adult in her life has ever said girls should be nurses. She's met male nurses. So it's as if she absorbs some totally unspoken leftover cultural message. No matter what we say to her consciously, she'd pick that up. And it's the same thing about, say, anorexia. It's not that we ever say to these girls, you need to be skinny to the point of endangering your health, but they somehow suck up that message. They kind of act out the cultural unconscious.
Right, yeah. That I want to read a little quick passage, what you were talking about everybody's different sort of bringing their own desires to the table. So this is a section in which it's easy to see, right, that the priest and the people who are allowing Anna to believe that she is a miracle, it's easy to judge them a little bit, right? But then this doctor comes, and he's really not much better. Standish had years, no decades of study and experience that Lib lacked, that no woman could ever obtain. Anna's downy, scaly skin, the puffy flesh, small matters in themselves, but was he right that they meant she was in actual danger from eating so little? Lib felt an impulse to put her arms around the child. She restrained it, of course. She remembered a freckled nurse at Scutari complaining that they weren't allowed to follow the prompts of the heart, to take a quarter of an hour, for instance, to sit with a dying man and offer a word of comfort. So just the sort of separation of the scientific mind and the rational mind and the emotional body and then the whole world of faith. I felt like that was part of Anna finds herself in this situation. The whole family finds themselves in the situation because those things are not allowed to meet.
I know what you mean. It's like that false old dichotomy between, you know, the flesh and the spirit, as if you ever could sever them, you know? I would say that distinction, which, you know, predates Christianity even. You get it in classical writing, the idea of, you know, spirit is good, flesh is bad, and it's a rather sinister distinction. And the very idea that a child would think that she was better off without her own body, you know, when anyone who's ever loved a child knows that, you know, their body is part of what you love most about them, you know?
Right. But that also, it seemed important to me that Anna was a girl who felt she was better off without her body, or that her body, the smaller she got, and the less she needed, the better she was in everybody else's eyes.
And the farther away from womanhood. I mean, exactly. Once you have a womanly body, the dangers and the costs are obvious.
Right, you can't turn back then. So she sort of paused herself at 11. It seems like just to have a female body feels very, very dangerous to her.
Yeah, and the bit you quoted from with, you know, Nightingale saying to her nurses, don't follow the impulses of the heart. I have a huge respect for Florence Nightingale because she transformed nursing in a single generation. It wasn't a slow progress thing at all. And nursing was basically this, you know, really low form of domestic service. You were like a scullery maid. You just, you know, sat beside people as they died or ran around cleaning. And Nightingale transformed it into this relatively prestigious, respectable, you know, virtuous job that educated women might do. But even with her, there was this sort of strand of, she was afraid of emotion. Yeah. And of course, she was working under terrible conditions in a big hurry. So basically she was saying to the nurses, you know, control your emotions so that you can run around saving the biggest number of lives. But one thing that really inspired me in writing this book was Florence Nightingale wrote a book called Notes on Nursing. And okay, she doesn't have a lot of the knowledge we have now about exactly how germs worked, but she was very good on the psychology of things like, you know, allow some sunlight to come in, and don't let your patient hear you whispering to the doctor about their case because they'll be all freaked out. It's much better to speak honestly to your patient. You know, flowers in the room, chat to them. If they don't have much appetite, don't leave the food sitting around in their rooms, you know. So she really paid attention to that nurse-patient relationship. And I suppose in this book, I wanted to show that Lib is a kind of a fervent student of Florence Nightingale, and she brings all those skills with her. But even she finds there's a moment where she needs to go way past that and take steps that Florence Nightingale would totally disapprove of. So in a way, I made it a situation where Lib is forced to ask herself the deepest questions about what it is to be a nurse and what it is to be a human being.
Yeah, that's somewhere in there. You need both of those things, but the line is blurry. There's not a clear separation. I had in graduate school, I had a teacher once say to a group of us writers, he said, "You can't have a character alone in going for a walk alone. You can't do that. You have to give them things to do. You have to give them objects to touch." And there are objects in this book, but like Room, it's a very small space that we're in most of the time with Lib and Anna alone in the room, and Anna is often asleep. And it's totally riveting. But that's what I'm saying. I am saying that he was probably right about us, you know, 22-year-old writers. We probably shouldn't have attempted to send a character alone on a walk to just think. But in your hands, we managed to get this really, really charged space, and that where nothing is happening, but everything is at stake. How do you do that?
I suppose you have to pick your situations very carefully. And it, really, this is not... It's not that I'm neurotic, really. I am not a shut-in. I do not lock my children up. You know, there are no little locked rooms in my life. I grew up in a house of 10 people. My own house is, you know, full of children and friends and so on. So I'm not like this. But all I can say is that it works in terms of narrative. If you confine people one way or another. I mean, I would say this novel is very different from Room because there are no locked doors. You know, Anna is enclosing herself. She's much more in that kind of hermit tradition. Whereas Jack in Room is very, you know, he happens to be locked up, but his mind is hugely expansive and buoyant. But, you know, either way, keeping people penned in together, it just, you know, increases the pressure, increases, it's like Brownian motion, you know, all those little atoms banging off the walls. It just works in narrative terms. It's like the locked room murder mystery. I just really like to get very, very close up with people and to find out exactly what's going through their minds moment by moment.
You do another thing that teacher did recommend doing, which was to really pay attention to your inventory, that every single object in the space has to matter. He would always say, you got to think like you're going to call the prop people and tell them, you know, look, these are the things that I need. And if it's not worth your budget, if that thing is not going to hold its weight, you get rid of it.
And a good principle for plays, when I've written plays, I always remember the line about, you know, if you have a gun hanging on the wall, somebody better fire it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
exactly. No wasted objects.
Right. And Lib goes, part of her work is to go around discovering what Anna has hidden in her chest and what might be in the walls and what the walls are made of. And she makes a very careful investigation of the entire space, and we come to understand everything that's in it. And then the stories of those things change as the book goes on.
Well, I wanted to give Anna's Catholicism a very physical side, partly because, you know, Catholicism does rather make a fetish of objects. You know, it's not Calvinism. There's an awful lot of collecting of little memorabilia and gadgets. And what's weird is that sometimes there'll be an artistic fashion within Catholicism, like pictures of the Sacred Heart of Jesus, right? Adult Jesus standing there, showing his heart, which is kind of revealed through his ribs, and he'll be pointing to it in a very kind of guilt-trippy way. And you see it bleeding, right? So this is basically a pictorial convention. But then the Catholic Church turned it into an institution. You know, they had a pope announce the kind of doctrine of the Sacred Heart, and then you got sodalities and Catholic organizations devoted to the Sacred Heart and sets of prayers to the Sacred Heart. And all this was just another way of describing Jesus, but they'll act like it's this brand new thing, like we now have the Sacred Heart. So I wanted to give Anna objects because I think any child, you know, likes her little collections, and she's got no toys. So I decided she would collect holy pictures, and she would have a few objects like a candlestick of the Virgin Mary. The only scholar I got in touch with directly when I was writing this book was an art historian, and I said to her basically what objects would be on the market in the 1850s that Anna could possibly have got, because, you know, she wouldn't be having some very big budget, but I knew she'd have things like a rosary beads and an Agnes Dei and so on. And, you know, this goes back to my childhood too. I was brought up in a very mild version of Catholicism, but still I had, you know, the little holy statues. And during Lent, when we all gave up sweets for Lent, there was an odd convention that if somebody offered you a, you know, a boiled sweet or something, a candy, during Lent, you could take it home and save it for Easter. So I built up this little collection of individual squares of chocolate and half-melted sweets, and I saved them all, like, in my little statue of, I think, St. Teresa. So, you know, you couldn't invent a better way to fixate the minds of children on candy all through Lent. It was a perfect example of, you know, if you try too hard to give something up, you just become more and more preoccupied with it. So yeah, Catholicism, I think, has always been a religion of objects, and it's always been accused by Protestantism of, in fact, you know, worshipping the golden calf, you know, getting too fond of objects.
Sure, yeah. Can you talk a little bit about what it's like to write about children in great peril as a mother?
Well, it's not as if motherhood is totally comfortable and then you're introducing dark ideas by writing these books. You know, every parent fears. We're constantly nearly losing our children under the wheels of cars, for instance. So, you know, during any day, you're going to have a little moment where you think, you know, oh, will they cut their fingers off? You know, the other day, and we were in a friend's house for Thanksgiving, and everybody was helping to peel the potatoes, and I thought, really, my 12-year-old son should help. So I ordered him to, and next thing, he's bleeding from the finger because he's managed to gash himself. So dangers all around, and other dangers too, you know. You snap at them, they look at you in a wounded way, and you think, this is the moment they will remember forever. They will forget the 2 days in Disneyland lining up for all the fun, and they'll just remember this moment when I hurt their feelings. So it's a perilous business. And to me, these grueling storylines, all they do is take the ordinary struggle of parenthood and show it in a sort of a harsh, isolating spotlight. I mean, we've all had battles with kids about food. We've all had battles with kids about autonomy and risk. So these storylines just take that kind of everyday battle and distill it, I would say.
Yeah, I think so. I think every novel presents completely different challenges. At least I've had that experience.
That's the fun of them.
Yeah, right? But does it? Do you feel like you are a beginner every time? Does it get easier? Do you know more?
Starting this book, I didn't feel I was any more ready to write it than in writing my first book. But there is a certain cumulative confidence that you say to yourself, I've done it before. I've you know, known nothing about a situation and then done the work, done the thinking as well as the research, and made myself able to bring this world to life. I know an Irish playwright called Bernard Farrell, every time he feels complete doubt and he gets down his published plays and he lays them all out on his bed, you know, like a kind of a comfort quilt of publication. And he says to himself, look, you wrote all these plays, surely you can do it again. So, I tend to feel confident, but that doesn't mean I feel just able to write a book out of my head. Every time I have to do the work. And with every novel I write, there's at least one technical subject that I find enormously difficult to understand. When I wrote a novel about an 18th century sculptor, it was so difficult to work out the process of how they used all their funny little devices to transfer the measurements from a little maquette to a big one. I was bewildered by that. And then when I, in the same novel, I had to figure out cockfighting as a sport. And first of all, I was repelled by it, but also it's very arcane details about silver spurs and steel spurs and so on. In my last novel, Frog Music, set in the 1870s in San Francisco, I had to do a few gambling scenes, and I can barely play Patience, you know. So figuring out the rules of Faro is just bewildering, and I'm still not sure that scene really holds up, you know. So in this novel, I really struggled to get the theology right. I didn't want huge wadges of theology, but obviously I wanted it to be correct. I didn't want to be misrepresenting the church. But I feel that I sort of fell down some pretty deep internet rabbit holes trying to work out exactly how many prayers you'd have to say to get a soul out of purgatory on a Friday as opposed to a different day of the week. And also, I had assumed that these sites would just be telling me about what people thought in the 1850s, but there are websites right now logging, like a database, logging the prayers that people are saying to get people out of out of purgatory. There are websites where people sign up to be martyrs. They don't mean actually die, but they mean that they are asking Jesus to give them as much pain and suffering in their lives as possible, like as a favor to him, on the assumption that he'll like that. So this particular strand in Catholicism has never died out. And of course, it's not just in Catholicism. I could have set this storyline in various parts of our world. Anywhere that the rules are very literal and extreme, and a girl might think that she has no other way out.
Absolutely. All right, I've just got one last question, and then we'll turn it over to you all. Somerset Mom said, there are three secrets to writing a novel. Unfortunately, nobody knows what they are.
That's a great one.
Let's pretend that you know one of those secrets at least. What is it?
I think you have to follow your own curiosity and even obsession. And whenever you think, but will the rest of the world care about a little girl not eating in 1850s Ireland? You have to say to yourself, doesn't matter, I care. You know, so just approach it like an obsession. Just go as deep as you can, just to answer your own questions, to gratify your own burning curiosity. So that's usually my method. But it does mean that when I describe to total strangers what my latest book is about, sometimes they just look repelled.
Thank you. That's a good one.
Questions? First question over here.
Hi. I was just curious, you mentioned when you were talking about your research a lot about the internet, and I was curious if that was your main source or if you did go to libraries or anywhere else to research.
I still use a lot of books, yeah. I developed my kind of research methods before the internet. So libraries, in fact, doing a PhD probably really helped me write historical fiction, not so much in what it taught me directly, but it just gave me this feeling that, you know, the answers are always out there in a library somewhere. You know, just because you know nothing at all about 14th century Japan to begin with, don't worry, you'll find it. And of course, you're always drawing on the research of others. People often assume that a novelist like me is doing a lot of primary research where you're discovering things in archives nobody's ever seen. Not a bit of it. We are almost always drawing on the research of others. So the internet I use mostly actually to find the obscure books I need. It's particularly useful for tracking down not just what books you need. Like, for my last novel, I had to track down one about the San Francisco coroner's office in the late 19th century. You know, so I find books like that, and I find what libraries they're in, or I track them down on Abe Books or something. And I also use websites, but often the websites, I mean, I often start with Wikipedia, and that's often giving you just the kind of the surface knowledge, but it's very useful, and then you find the deeper rabbit holes to go down. So yeah, it's never just internet, but the internet is an amazing machine for sort of accessing books. And often, you know, you can do a quick search of them too. It used to be that when people wrote historical novels, then in their acknowledgements, they would say something like, and thank you to my husband who came with me to Germany 5 summers in a row, going from library to library, you know. But nowadays, you really don't have to be free to uproot your life and go repeatedly to Germany. There are lots of ways to access the knowledge. So the internet has been wonderfully democratizing. Another huge way it has changed and improved things is that so many sources now are digitized, newspapers in particular. With my last novel, Frog Music, which was based on a real murder case, I used about 60 different newspaper articles about the woman who'd been shot. So that kind of stuff is hugely helpful. Also, genealogical sites. Again, in my last novel, I wanted to find out what happened to a particular young man who was accused of killing the woman in my novel. And through the Mormon's family history website, I found out that he got married shortly after, because they keep such amazing records. So, and also a lot of individuals share their knowledge on genealogical websites. So that's, again, an amazing kind of network of knowledge. So oddly enough, the internet has been the best possible thing for history as a trade. And it's allowed very specialist histories to be shared worldwide, whereas they used to be kind of, you know, just buried in the local historical society's publications. So So yeah, you know, it's easier and easier to do this kind of research.
On your books that you write, and you say you're inspired when you go, do you normally finish the books where you first started to get inspired on, or do you go back home and finish it there and just not go back and see if you miss something? The question is, when you get write a book, inspired to it, do you normally go to the place that you want to write it to?
Good question. I would say going to the place is often something I do relatively late because, for instance, my last novel is set in 1870 San Francisco. And obviously, I have been to San Francisco over the years and I like it. But 1870 San Francisco is not there. The earthquake and the fire destroyed it. So in a way, to spend too much time looking at modern San Francisco would give me a wrong impression. For instance, my characters all lived in Chinatown. Chinatown now is full of all this cute kind of Chinese decor. None of that was there in the 1870s. In the 1870s, it was a very cramped little ghetto with no Eastern-looking architecture at all. So you could be really misled by how it looks nowadays. So I mostly try and find the old place, like 1850s Ireland, through, for instance, old photographs online. Those are really, really helpful. Through reading tour guides of the time, and through reading what visitors said when they passed through a place. So I usually try and harvest all that knowledge to build up my own sense of what the place was like. And at a certain point, I might go to the area just to see what the actual landscape is like. You know, the stuff that has not changed as much. But very often, the place I'm writing about, if it's set in a previous century, it's really not there anymore. So I have to try and just make it really vivid in my mind and use maps and photographs.
I just wanted to ask if about frog music, if Blanche is based a little bit on Lola Montez.
No, actually, Lola Montez was another fascinating performer at the time. But no, no, Blanche was just a real person who was an erotic dancer and a prostitute who was in a room with the frog catcher Jenny Bonnet when she got shot. I, of course, had to flesh out things like what Blanche's act might have been like. So in trying to work out what her performances would be like, I looked at a huge number of postcards of burlesque dancers at the time with their crazy costumes. And again, you know, looking at some modern equivalent like strippers would be quite misleading because in the 1870s, they didn't strip. They didn't take off their clothes one by one. They just had very sort of sexy costumes but left them on. But the sexy costume might include a horse's head. You know, they had a lot of comical elements that you'd see more like in a mascot for a football game nowadays. And also, they didn't tend to reveal their breasts at all. They showed their legs, basically. They tended to have gauzy tights on. All the focus was in the legs. Yeah, so I drew on lots of performers of the time, yeah, but no one particular one.
Thank you. That was so wonderful. Thank you, Emma. It's been great to be here.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the Estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information. 17.